Fiona Kelly joins us with It Says in the Papers.
All papers apart from the Irish Times and Irish Examiner lead today with the tragic death of two brothers at their home in County Sligo. All papers describe how Shane and Carmel Skeffington arrived home on Sunday evening to find 9-year-old Brandon mortally wounded inside the house, and how they later found the body of their eldest son, 20-year-old Shane, in a shed at the back of the house. Local people described how the first they knew of the incident was when they heard the air ambulance helicopter which took Brandon to Sligo General Hospital. The detached family home which Shane Skeffington built for his family just outside Tubber Curry 8 years ago, which was being examined by forensic officers yesterday, is pictured in all of today's papers, as is the detail that Shane Jr. was due in court tomorrow on a charge of possessing a small amount of cocaine for his personal use. For its lead story today, The Times reports that the Public Accounts Committee plans a robust response to former rehab chief Angela Cairns, who filed a High Court action for compensation yesterday, arising from the investigation earlier this year into the rehab group. The Irish Independent and Examiner also put this story on their front pages today. I lost 240k job and spent 10 days in hospital after pack ordeal, is the headline in The Independent. The Examiner leads today with the story about how the Taoiseach is being called upon to clarify if radical reforms to the medical card system will now take place, following a suggestion by the Minister for Health, Leo Varadkar, that a system based on someone's health instead of their financial needs would not be realistic. The decision by pro-Russian rebels in Ukraine to release both the black box flight recorders for Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 and the bodies of the 298 people killed in the crash is also covered on the front of today's Times. And also in the Times, Ruan McCormack writes from the border in Israel that locals there fully support the invasion of Gaza. While writing from Berlin, Derek Scally writes that the conflict has triggered an explosion of violent hatred of Jews in Germany. And in its lead editorial today, the paper urges the international community to step up its efforts to secure a swift and enduring ceasefire. The redevelopment of Priory Hall will cost about €27 million, almost three times the original estimate. That's also in the front of the Times. And elsewhere this morning, most of today's papers report on Bill Cullen's hearing in the Commercial Court yesterday against the sale of the assets of his companies by receivers, in which he said that there is no doubt that his €11.5 million debt to Ulster Bank will be cleared. Two cases before the Equality Tribunal are covered in most of today's court pages. Born-again Christian John McAteer, who was fired from South Tipperary County Council, was awarded €70,000 after the tribunal found that he was discriminated against over his religion. And retired teacher Brian Bogle was awarded €8,000 after the tribunal found that the City of Dublin VEC refused to shortlist him for a job interview on account of his age. The legal row over the €1 million legal bill owed by Owen McKeough, the 23-year-old student who went to court to permanently remove an internet video clip falsely accusing him of taxi fare evasion, is also carried in most of today's papers. The Examiner, meanwhile, has a picture today of Gaeltacht Minister Joe McHugh arriving to begin his week of Irish College at Iddos Gael in Glencolumbkill yesterday, and we're told that the minister got upgraded to the Level 3 class, which comes just below Level 4 for fluency. Speakers. But finally, pictures of the latest arrival at Dublin Zoo, the 12-stone, 1.2-metre tall baby elephant, are carried in most of today's papers, as is the fascinating description of the ritual surrounding the birth. The director of the zoo, Leo Oosterveld, tells Evelyn Ring in today's Examiner how they knew that something was happening when the herd of elephants became restless. For a whole hour there was absolute mayhem, he says. The elephants started milling around and the calf was born within a forest of 16 legs. They would all push the calf to get it going, and sometimes one of the bigger elephants would lean down on one knee to take a really close look at the newborn. And as a result of their efforts, we're told that the baby elephant took his first steps after 8 minutes.
Fiona, thank you.
With the news in detail, here's Brian Jennings.
Pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine have handed over the two flight recorders from flight MH17 to Malaysian experts in Donetsk. The separatists also announced a ceasefire within a 10-kilometre radius of the site of the Malaysian Airlines crash, in which 298 people were killed after it was apparently hit by a surface-to-air missile. The United Nations Security Council has unanimously adopted a resolution demanding full and unrestricted access to the crash site, which is in rebel-held areas. After the vote, the US ambassador Samantha Power questioned Russia's claim of Ukrainian complicity in the downing of the airliner.
But if Russia genuinely believed that Ukraine was involved in the shootdown of Flight 17, surely President Putin would have told the separatists, many of whose leaders are from Russia, to guard the evidence at all costs, to maintain a forensically pure, hermetically sealed crime scene. We welcome Russia's support for today's resolution, but no resolution would have been necessary had Russia used its leverage with the separatists on Thursday, getting them to lay down their arms and leave the site to international experts.
Russia's UN ambassador, Vitaly Churkin, said Russia was ready to assist the international investigation, but warned against jumping to conclusions on who was to blame.
Russia, for its part, stands ready to provide any assistance necessary in organizing and conducting impartial international investigations. Russian military members and civilian bodies have already been provided with the necessary instructions here. However, there can be no jumping to conclusions nor political statements here.
Palestinian police say Israeli airstrikes have hit more than 70 targets in Gaza overnight, including five mosques, a football stadium, and the home of a dead Hamas leader. They say 13 people were killed. Israel says two more of its soldiers had died in continuing clashes. More than 580 Palestinians and 29 Israelis have died in the 2 weeks since Israel launched its military offensive against Hamas militants in response to rocket attacks. Over 3,600 Palestinians have been injured. On this programme, Dr. Mads Gilbert, a Norwegian doctor working in Gaza, said the majority of the injured are women and children. He described the working conditions for doctors as the offensive continues.
Many of the children have injuries that we have to do surgical procedures without taking them to the operating room, because we simply don't have capacity in the operating room to do everything there. So we have to do it in makeshift dressing rooms and local anesthesia.
Diplomatic efforts to broker a truce in the Gaza conflict have intensified, with the US Secretary of State John Kerry holding talks with the US UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon in the Egyptian capital Cairo. The United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees says more than 100,000 people have now sought shelter with them due to the conflict. John Kerry has pledged more than $47 million in humanitarian aid for the territory. He demanded more attention for the plight of Palestinian civilians.
We are deeply concerned about the consequences of Israel's appropriate and legitimate effort to defend itself. No country can stand by while rockets are attacking it. But always, in any kind of conflict, there is a concern about civilians, about children, women, communities.
EU foreign ministers meet in Brussels today for talks expected to be dominated by the crises in Ukraine and Gaza. The new Minister for Foreign Affairs, Charlie Flanagan, will be attending his first meeting of the Council. From Brussels, our Europe correspondent Paul Cunningham.
This Foreign Affairs Council will be overshadowed by the downing of the Malaysian Airlines plane MH17 over eastern Ukraine, in which a Dublin woman was tragically killed. The Netherlands is expected to be pressing for the issue to be dealt with as a priority by ministers after more than 190 of its citizens were killed in the crash. Last week, EU leaders decided to increase the pressure on Russia after President Putin was deemed to have failed to exert his influence to end the conflict in Ukraine. However, ministers will not consider this issue in detail, as a report on the expansion of sanctions will not be ready until the end of the month. The other significant issue to be discussed is the crisis in Gaza, in which the UN has said has led to 87,000 Palestinians taking sanctuary in schools. It's expected Minister Flanagan will articulate Ireland's view that any EU Council statement must not just focus on ending the immediate conflagration, but also restate the long-held objective of negotiating a two-state solution. Paul Cunningham, RT News, Brussels.
Police in Afghanistan say a Taliban suicide bomber detonated a device outside Kabul International Airport, killing three foreign advisers and an Afghan interpreter. The nationalities of the advisers to the Afghan government were not immediately clear. New research identifying the biology underlying schizophrenia could lead to innovations in treatment for the disorder. The results of an international study on the genetic basis of the disease has been published today online in the journal Nature. The research was conducted by an international team, including scientists from Trinity College Dublin. 60 new jobs have been announced in separate investments in Cork and Portlaoise. 40 IT jobs have been promised for Cork by a Californian company, Alien Vault. 20 new customer support jobs have been announced in Portlaoise by technology company Internal Results Ireland Limited. Dublin City Council has placed a temporary prohibition of bathing notice at Sandymount Strand due to concerns about water quality. Samples are being tested and the results will be available tomorrow when a further update will be issued. Now the time is coming up to 8 minutes past eight. The weather forecast, it will be warm and humid today with some hazy sunshine, best in eastern areas, but generally cloudy and misty with hill and coastal fog. There will be showery rain and drizzle also, especially in western areas. This will be heavy at times with some thundery bursts locally. Highest temperatures 19 to 24 degrees.
It's day 15 of Operation Protective Edge, Israel's offensive into Gaza. Nearly 600 Palestinians, mostly civilians, are dead. 29 Israelis, mostly soldiers, are dead. Rockets are still being fired by Israel into Gaza this morning and by Hamas into Israel. Israel's ambassador to Ireland is Boaz Modai, and he's on the phone. Ambassador, good morning.
Good morning, Gavin.
15 days, over 600 dead. When is this going to stop?
I wish I'd known. Israel was ready to for a ceasefire last week. We accepted the Egyptian and the Arab League offer. The Hamas kept on shooting. Actually, the Hamas doesn't stop its launching of rockets for the last 14 years, since Israel left Gaza district unilaterally in 2005. Since then, 14,000 rockets have been shot towards Israel indiscriminately in order to kill Israeli civilians. I believe that Israel, like any other country in the world, has the right to defend itself.
But you've killed over 600 citizens, mostly civilians, 29 dead on the Israeli side. What does Israel want?
We want quiet. This is all we want. We want to dismantle the ability of the Hamas to shoot at us on a regular basis, on a daily basis, and we want to find a solution to the terror tunnel. People do not understand that there are two Gaza, the one that you see on the TV with the civilians, and the other one underground, miles and miles of tunnels that were built. It cost a lot of money, and they received a lot of money for the rehabilitation of Gaza in the last few years. And these are tunnels that can get, there are three kinds of them. One that goes from Egypt to Gaza, the other one in the center of Gaza, and the third type is those that are meant to get, the underground going into Israeli territory. And the biggest fear is that one of these tunnels would go into a kibbutz in the south, and one day a group of 10 militants, 10 terrorists, would come out and shoot and would create a massacre and would kill tens or hundreds of civilians in these kibbutz. And this is our fear. We have to find a solution for that.
You talk about quiet. To quote Daniel Levy, a former advisor to an Israeli prime minister, what have the Palestinians got in return for quiet? Because on the West Bank, the Fatah's government cooperation with Israel is rewarded with more and more Israeli settlements, and the reward for quiet in Gaza is simply the continuation of the blockade, both on land and on sea. What do the Palestinians get in return for stopping?
No, this is one of the things that I think that we should concentrate at the moment with Gaza, because the other is a problem that should be solved. We were on the negotiating table with the Palestinian Authority for a few months, but it didn't get anywhere because the Palestinian Authority do not accept the fact that there should be a compromise. And the compromise means that they cannot get everything they want. We understand that there is going to be a Palestinian state. The Prime Minister Netanyahu said it many times. He said that the only solution is two states for two people living in peace with each other.
But you're continuing to encroach on one part of that state and blockading the other.
No, there is no blockade on Gaza. There is only maritime blockade. People don't see the difference. And that was put on Gaza only after a few vessels coming from Iran with ammunition and missiles were intercepted by the Israeli Navy.
There is no blockade. There is no blockade on Gaza, you say?
There is no blockade on ground. You don't. Maybe you don't know, but in the last during this operation, in the last 2 weeks, almost 700 trucks with merchandise, goods, food, medicine, anything that is needed, went through the Kerem Shalom crossing into Gaza. This is what Israel does to help the Palestinians. I don't see the Hamas helping them the same. By the way, 2 days ago, Israel built a field hospital to help wounded civilians from Gaza, just near the Erez crossing. We do that because we care about the Palestinians much more than Hamas cares about them.
If you care about Palestinians, why have you just bombed a hospital in Gaza?
I don't know to which thing you're referring to, but you have to understand that the biggest bunker of the Hamas is under the largest hospital, Shifa Hospital in Gaza. Now we know that we are doing our utmost not to hit civilians, but we should understand that every civilian that dies as a result of this violence was murdered by the Hamas. That what the Hamas is doing is a genocide against their own people. We should understand that. I know that people in the West find it very difficult to understand how come they want their people to be killed. But the Hamas is doing a double war crime. They shoot at civilians and they hide behind their civilians who serve as human shields. And for them, any casualty is a victory. If it's an Israeli, that's good. And if it's a Palestinian, it's PR victory.
Ambassador, even if your claim is true that rockets are being hid close to a hospital, how does that justify hitting a hospital?
I really don't know to which case you're referring to.
The hospital in Gaza that was hit in the last 48 hours.
I don't know. Which hospital? I really don't know the details about that one, but I can assure you that if something like that happened, it wasn't intentional, that these things, you should understand, can happen. One should realize that it's a battlefield is something, if you haven't experienced that, you are lucky, because it's a very ugly place and the terrible things can happen there and a lot of mistakes. If Israel wanted really just to kill Palestinians, why would we put our soldiers in danger and almost 30 of them were already killed? We could have just bombed them from the air.
Just in case you weren't aware, it's the Al-Aqsa Hospital which was hit. Israeli tanks hit the Al-Aqsa Hospital on Sunday, killing four patients and one medic in the hospital.
Again, I mean, you can bring different examples. I don't know about this one in particular, but it doesn't matter. The fact is that what we do is we do all the in our power not to hit civilians, not to hit schools. Mosques, and in these mosques, for example, the Hamas hides their missiles. Only 2 days ago, or 3 days ago, UNRWA revealed that 20 missiles were hidden in a school of UNRWA. I mean, they break every rule, war rule that exists.
We are
trying to do the opposite.
How can you do your best not to target civilians in a tiny area where 2 million people are living?
Exactly. This is why it is so complicated and difficult. But do we have any other choice? Are we supposed to let every hour to missiles to land in Israel? Only yesterday, 137 missiles were targeted towards Israel. We are lucky because we prepared ourselves for that. We have an anti-missile program, a project, the Iron Dome, and we have shelters. Because the government of Israel cares about its people, and we try to protect them. While the Hamas, all the money they had, instead of trying to protect their people, they just put it in the terror tunnels and in the armaments and missiles that they use.
We've had a number of Israeli spokespeople on the program in recent days, and indeed on other media outlets, who say that they are warning Palestinian civilians to leave areas where they're going to send bombs into.
That's true.
Where are these Palestinians supposed to go?
To other places. We very often look, for example, at the moment there is a very difficult battle in Sajaiya, which is a neighborhood very dense, but this is the center of the terror tunnels. We advised Palestinians to leave this neighborhood at least for a short while, and we told them exactly where to go. Some people decided to leave, but since the Hamas threatens them and asks them not to leave, many of them do stay, and unfortunately, in some cases, they are being hit, and that's terrible. It is sad. You know, I'm really sad for every innocent person that is killed, but that is a result of a war under these conditions.
Last week, when we spoke to one representative of your foreign ministry, she suggested rather that one place where Palestinians could hide from the bombs from Israel was the beach, and yet a few days later, four Palestinian boys playing on that very beach were killed by naval shellfire. Can you understand people's concerns that you're asking people to leave in a crowded area where they're continuing to be being bombed? There's no place for them to escape.
What is the solution?
Stop bombing them.
And? Do you know any other country in the world that would have accepted being hit by missiles on a daily basis? As I mentioned, 137 yesterday, 120 the day before. I must say that there is one thing, there is a claim against Israel that our reaction is not proportional. I think that the only thing that is not proportional is the attitude towards this conflict comparing to others. From the beginning of the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, I'm speaking about 48, 22,000 people died on both sides, which is an amazing number. It's really frightening. But from the beginning of this year, the beginning of 2014, 30,000 people died in Syria. Now, if you look at the media today, you get the impression that everything that is happening today happens in this little district of Gaza, while there is so much violence going on all around us. I'm not saying that the media shouldn't deal with it, but we should put the right proportions here. And people should know the facts. A lot of people are not aware of that. I saw demonstrations in this country, in this city, just a little while ago, not even mentioning that Israel is being hit on a daily basis. I mean, what do people expect? Why is Israel the only country in the world that doesn't have the right to defend itself?
Can you give me an example of another country in the world that has hit a hospital?
Check in Syria. Check what's happening in Iraq these days. In Libya. Yemen.
Are you putting Israel on an equivalence with Syria and Libya?
No.
Can you give me an example of another? Of another civilized country?
Yes.
That
yes,
has targeted
hospitals. I will give an example. In 1999, in Kosovo, you probably know that NATO bombarded the city. And when I speak about NATO, I speak about Western democratic country, including some European countries. During this war, they bombarded 14,000 tons, many thousands of missiles. As a result, 2,000 civilians were killed, many of them children.
How is
that
this
happened? They hit 300 schools were destroyed, hospitals. These things happen in a war. People do not understand what the war is all about.
Where's the way out of this, Ambassador? How is this going to end?
I hope with a ceasefire, and I hope it would be soon. Nobody wants that to go on. I just received by mail at this moment an annunciation from my daughter and my children that are staying with her, that they are back home because there was a siren and they had to run for the shelter. And I got, just a few minutes ago, I got a little bit panicked. So I hope that this would end. I know a lot of our soldiers that are there in Gaza, my nephew, friend, children of my friends. Nobody wants that to go on, but there should be a solution. And and I heard the Palestinian ambassador speaking in your program yesterday when he accuses Israel without taking any responsibility. If the Palestinian Authority has an agreement now and the unity government together with the Hamas, why can't they stop them? Abu Mazen is supposed to be he's the president. He's supposed to take responsibility, but they don't. They just put all the burden on Israel, and we are being accused of using excessive force instead of understanding in which situation we are. We were dragged into this conflict. Before it started, Prime Minister Netanyahu said time and again, quiet would be responded with quiet, but there was no quiet. And as long as there is no solution to this problem, we will have to keep on retaliating. That is the only option we have.
Will you talk to Hamas about a ceasefire and a permanent solution?
We talked in the past with Hamas indirectly.
Will you talk now to Hamas?
Indirectly, I guess we will. the Egyptians are in our opinion, quite good moderators. As I said before, last week they offered a ceasefire, and we accepted it. It's the Hamas who wasn't ready for that. I hope that now they are more ready.
And if those talks aren't forthcoming, is there any point at which Israel, as a civilized, as a democratic country, is going to draw a line? Is there a point at which the cost in human life becomes too great to bear?
I wish I'd known how you do that. Really. I mean, it's as long as you're being attacked, there is no other option but to retaliate. You also have to remember that we live in a neighborhood in which weakness is being any restraint is being seen as a weakness and not as a strength. And if Israel loses one war, it's the last war. We are not going to get a second chance. So we have to. This is why we have a strong army, and this is why we keep ourselves, because there is no other option for us.
Irrespective of the number of people, the number of innocent civilians who are killed in the process, you say you're distressed by what you see in Gaza. Is there not a point at which it just becomes too much when Israel says, we can't do this anymore?
And then what? And then what? So let's say that Israel unilaterally decides to stop the operation, but the Hamas keeps on shooting at our cities. What do we do then?
Well, at the moment, your Iron Dome system, which is hugely funded by the United States, seems to be keeping you quite well protected.
Quite well protected, but I don't think there is any other people. First of all, it's only a matter of luck. I mean, I know of so many occasions in the last 2 weeks that the difference between five people being killed or the fact that they were not hit is just a matter of 50 meters. There are a lot of miracles here too, with all due respect to the Iron Dome system. But except for that, let's say that these missiles don't kill anyone. Do you still believe that any other country in the world would have accepted being bombarded on a daily basis without responding? I don't think this exists. And if you can give me an example of something like that, I'd be very happy to hear.
Ambassador, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning. That's Israel's ambassador to Ireland, Boaz Modai'i, speaking to us on the phone here in Dublin.
Darren has the sport.
Good morning, Rachel. We'll start with some very good news indeed. The Republic of Ireland under-19 women's team have booked a place in the semi-finals of the European Championships. They beat Sweden last night by 2-1. The Swedes won this particular tournament 2 years ago. The Irish now face the Netherlands for a place in the final on Thursday. I'm delighted to say I'm joined by the Irish manager Dave Connell from Norway. Dave, have this team exceeded all expectations over there?
Oh, certainly so, yeah. I don't think we realised how good these girls were until we got here, but they've certainly stepped up to the mark here and they're doing very, very well.
Now, I read that the Swedish manager didn't have some nice things to say about you earlier in the year. How big a motivation was that?
Yeah, you know, things happen in football.
What did he say?
We answered him last night.
What did he say to you a few months back?
Well, he said we were a good hurling team, but, you know, we took it as a motivation and we got on with the job last night and we played very, very well and played some lovely stuff on the night and we were worthy winners.
Oh, fantastic. What level of competition, what's it like over there? And in terms of your ranking going into the tournament, where were you expected to finish?
Well, we came in as the best runners-up during March. There's a league phase, there's a couple of groups, so we came in as the best runners-up of the groups. We played the Netherlands in that group. We drew 0-0 with them in the Netherlands. So we were 8th seed coming into the competition now, the 8 countries. So that was another motivational factor for us. We wanted to prove people that we're actually better than the 8th seed tag that we were given. And we've certainly done that.
I know a lot of this team have already done their leaving cert, and there's a lot more to do their leaving cert next year. So a very young bunch and obviously lots of prospects for the future. But in terms of the geography, where are these girls from in the country?
Yeah, from all over. We have Savannah McCarthy, who captained our 17. She's from Listowel in Kerry. We have Kiva Keenan, who came on against England and played again yesterday, from Ballymun in Dublin. We've Roman McLaughlin, the youngest player in the competition at 16. She She's from Inishowen in Donegal. So they're spread around the country quite a lot. And with all the different backgrounds, the girls certainly get on absolutely fantastically. And that's probably one of the keys why we're doing so well, the manner in which the girls get on and off the pitch.
Can we beat the Dutch on Thursday, Dave?
Yeah, I feel that we can beat them. They're a very, very good side. They've a lot of good players playing in big clubs that we all know of within Holland. One of their players recently signed for Bayern Munich, which would be a huge club, women's wise as well. So they've a lot of players with a lot of pedigree. But you know, we've something special in this group that's very, very hard to beat. And we will certainly be going into the game confident. We won't be overconfident. Well, we'll have the girls well drilled, and the Dutch will certainly know that they're in for a game on Thursday.
We hope so. Irish manager Dave Connell, good luck on Thursday, and thanks very much for taking the call this morning. Shamrock Rovers beat Cork City 2-0 in the quarterfinals of the EA Sports Cup last night. Celtic back in Champions League action this evening. They have a 1-0 lead going to the second leg of their qualifier against KR Reykjavik at Murrayfield. Now, the Wexford County Board are not happy with their allocation of tickets for the All-Ireland Hurling quarterfinal doubleheader at Semple Stadium this coming weekend. They held an emergency meeting last night. They've decided to suspend ticket sales for the game against Limerick tomorrow. I'm joined on the line by RTÉ analyst and former Wexford All-Ireland winner Tom Dempsey. What's the problem down there, Tom?
Well, I suppose, Darren, it's not a problem, so to speak, because the county has gone absolutely hurling crazy down here. We had 13 or 14,000 people, I'd say, last week at the Waterford game, and we're estimating that there's a bigger crowd expected for next Sunday's game, Darren. The problem seems to be that the demand for stand tickets has vastly exceeded the allocation given. From my information, Darren, and we're only getting bits and pieces here, there have been 2,000 tickets, stand tickets allocated. The clubs already have looked for about 5,000 tickets. And, you know, I think it's the same with other counties in fairness. But the problem here, Darren, is that with such a lack of stand tickets, take older people, you know, some fans won't travel if they haven't got a stand ticket. They won't stand on the terraces. So it seems to be a bit of an issue down here. And I'll tell you, it's creating a lot of anxious people around, because everybody now wants to see Wexford hurl at the moment.
Well, Wexford officials expected to make a formal request to have the games moved to Croke Park. It's a little bit late in the day for that. Do you think the GAA will take that request seriously, Tom?
I don't know, Darren. It really is, as you say, very late in the day. Croke Park would seem to be the great answer here to that, now that we don't have Garth there. But logistically, in fairness to Thurles, I suppose, you know, they're expecting this game and businesses around the town. It may not be an option, but certainly Croke Park would be a good option from the point of view of facilitating every person that wants to see the match. And really, Darren, down here, all we want is we have a little bit of a thing going at the moment. We don't want to take our focus off the game, but certainly everybody that wants to see the game should be able to see it in comfort, Darren.
Okay, Tom Dempsey, good talking to you. Stage 16 finally of the Tour de France takes the peloton into the Pyrenees today. Vincenzo Nibali leads a 4 minutes and 37 second lead in the general classification, but Nicholas Roach, 48th overall, he's over 90 minutes behind. His big hope now this week is targeting a stage win.
And everyone asks me how you would go for a stage, like asking a kid if he wants to win the World Cup, and it would be very disrespectful to come to the Tour and hope not to win a stage. And I'm like one of those who are dreaming of those stage wins.
Finally, your impressions on the race leader Vincenzo Nibali?
He's been a hungry shark, as his nickname is the shark. But he's been extremely, extremely strong. His team is extremely strong. They're doing a great job. You know, it's 2 weeks now that they're fighting there, and they've never been caught out. They're always in control. And you know, at this stage, unless anything crazy happens, I can't see him being beaten.
That's Nicholas Roach speaking to Shane Stokes there. Finally, there's racing in Ballinrobe this evening. Action gets underway at 5:45.
Thank you very much, Darren. The Lord Mayor, Councillor Christy Burke, says he plans to present the book to the Dutch ambassador to Ireland on behalf of the city. Of the 298 people killed, 193 were from the Netherlands. Our reporter Laura Whelan has been speaking to those signing the book of condolences, including a Dutch tourist who lost a colleague in the disaster.
I think all the Dutch people are in sadness at the moment, because we don't know what exactly happened and so many Dutch are lost. We all are connected to someone. It's a small country, and I signed it because one of my colleagues in work in the theatre is lost of a special group, and I read it in the paper, and so all the things we are so close connected to all what happened.
It's just a shocking tragedy. Those poor people can't stop thinking, and that poor Irish lady as well. So I hope that to get to the bottom of it, and somebody has to be found for that. It's a crime, yeah, it's a crime, and somebody fired that missile that brought that down. All those holidaymakers and those good people, especially that professor, that aid specialist from Holland, really, I mean, a good man doing well for people, to be in his life like that, that's not right.
Well, I just saw on Sky News there before we came out, like, that the bodies haven't even been returned to the families, and I just don't know what's going on, to be honest with you. I just think it's a terrible disaster. Jesus, it's horrific, like, to know.
I thought to express my condolences, and the only way I can was to sign the book. I mean, 3 months ago we had the plane, the other Boeing lost, with 100 lives lost there, and this time it's 298 lives lost and gone forever. And the amount of grief that will cause to those families is a multiple of that. So the people affected are in their thousands alone, and that's how tragic the event is. It should never have happened. And instead of having wars continually around the world, we should have peace and words of peace.
It's just such a tragedy, you know, when planes have been knocked down out of the sky and there's nothing else you can do about it. Like, what can we do here apart from that? You know, for everybody, whether they be Irish, English, you know, any part of the world, people have lost their whole families.
It's a tragedy that crosses borders, so it's just out of respect, I guess. There was one Canadian on board.
Councillor Christy Burke, Lord Mayor of Dublin. When I discovered there was an Irish woman, a Dublin woman, who had been home to look after her sick mother from Palmerston, and was living in Australia, I was just touched. And I have to say that a large number of my own constituents in the north inner city, and indeed in Croke Park, had mentioned the lady and how sad they felt for her. And I immediately then asked the staff to immediately put up a book of condolence.
We just visited Dublin for a few days, and we saw the Lord Mayor coming in, and we asked someone what was happening, and then we thought it would be a lovely opportunity for us to do something meaningful as well, because this is in everyone's thoughts. I mean, it's horrific. Isn't it always the innocent? The world over, it's always the innocent that suffer.
That report from Laura Whelan, and that book of condolences at City Hall in Dublin is available for the public to sign today and Wednesday from 9:30 in the morning until 5 p.m. Well, for the latest from Ukraine, we can talk now to Matt Fry of Channel 4 News. Matt, will you tell us first of all about this handing over of the plane's black boxes? Who handed them over and who accepted them?
Well, they were handed over in late last night in a very solemn ceremony, replete with political messages for the local leadership here. They were handed over by Mr. Borodai, who's declared president of the self-declared People's Republic of Donetsk, to two aviation officials from Malaysia. They're not black, of course, they are orange. They're about the size of two melons. And they came out of a cardboard box and were cradled as carefully as a baby, as handed over to these officials. They are now in safe storage somewhere, I assume. The officials that received them are actually about three vehicles in front of me at the moment. We're driving in a convoy back to the crash site. So this will be the first time that Malaysian airline officials, representatives of the airliner that went down, will get a view of the place where flight MH17 crashed. So that will be quite significant in itself. Whether these officials will be able to sift through some of the wreckage and come to some sort of initial conclusion about what may or may not have happened is doubtful. I think this is just really a very first and tentative step towards what will be a much bigger, more forensic and more complicated investigation.
What's happening then at the crash site now?
Well, the crash site has been sort of abandoned, really. I mean, the bodies are, as you know, on this refrigerated train heading towards a city called Kharkiv, which is where they will be then placed on a transport plane flown back to the Netherlands. It is in the Netherlands that most of the forensic work will take place. Some of it may be in Kharkiv, but most of it in the Netherlands, to be honest, because that's where they'll have the space, and the peace, and the privacy to work properly. And then at the crash site itself, what will be interesting to see is how much of the wreckage remains. I mean, yesterday we saw large chunks of wreckage being removed, on whose orders we don't know, where to we don't know either. But if you think back at other crashes, it takes months, if not years, to find all the wreckage and then reconstruct the wreckage, literally rebuild the plane with the bits that they have found in order to try and get some more complete picture. That tends to happen in an airport hangar somewhere, and it is a very painstaking task. And if that is indeed what's going to happen here, it's going to take a very long time to gather together millions of pieces of wreckage strewn over a 10, 11-mile radius.
Matt Fry of Channel 4 News, thank you for taking our call this morning. Former chief executive of Rehab, Angela Kearns, has started legal action against the Doyle Public Accounts Committee, claiming that its members engaged in a witch hunt, which resulted in her losing her job and spending 10 days in hospital. Ms Kearns and her predecessor, Frank Flannery, appeared before a lengthy session of that committee back in February when they were quizzed about their earnings and the way the company is run. Joining us on the line is the chair of the Public Accounts Committee, John McGuinness. Good morning.
Good morning, Ray.
Not only does Angela Kearns want you to stop pursuing her, she's also claiming damages. What's your response?
Well, firstly, let me correct what you just said. Frank Flannery did not appear at that hearing. It was Angela Kearns alone that appeared at the hearing. My response generally is that this affidavit has been lodged with the High Court. I understand that now there's a number of months within which the papers will be served on the Oireachtas. Prior to that and leading up to the serving of the papers, we will be putting together our case and defending our position robustly. The hearings were about the Section 38, Section 39 grants. We were dealing with all of the accounting officers from the various departments and agencies, and because of the fact that Rehab had such an amount of funding from the department, they were invited in and they came.
So you will be fighting this in court?
Of course we will. I mean, the Oireachtas and the Public Accounts Committee is there to carry out a particular function. We carried out that function within our remit. We spoke about taxpayers' money. We were dealing with the governance and so on that arose out of the Section 38s and 39s and the agreements that they had with the HSE and other agencies. And therefore, we were perfectly entitled to examine the accounts. I believe that in all of this, that the members treated fairly all of the witnesses that came before us and gathered together a volume of information which will now form the subject of our report to the Oireachtas.
Well, as you know, they claim that that wasn't the case, that they weren't treated fairly. You're saying that the Public Accounts Committee will be fighting this. Who pays your legal bills?
Well, because of the fact that this is a case brought by one person yesterday before the court, we did not have the opportunity to defend the position. Therefore, what you're reading now is the account of one person about their position, and in this case against the Public Accounts Committee. The Public Accounts Committee will have to defend the case, and the state will have to, I'm sure, or the Oireachtas Commission will have to pay for the legal costs. But this is something that has to be challenged because fundamental to this is the accountability of agencies and individuals within agencies and so on that are funded by the government to account for themselves.
And have you been speaking to other members of the committee about this?
No, because yesterday in the afternoon, I understand this was taken to the High Court, and thereafter then the members were advised and given a copy of the papers. But the fact now is that we have to fully inform all of the members through our legal advisors to the Oireachtas, and that will be done in due course.
Is there a chance, though, that some of them mightn't want to defend this in court?
There's no option but to defend it, because what's being said has to be defended, because we have the committee has a different point of view. And I say that because if they had a view that sided with Ms. Kearns, then we would not have conducted the hearings.
But isn't there some evidence that all isn't well on the committee? I mean, we had this row last week during which John Deasy of Fine Gael accused some of his colleagues, well, I won't use the word on air at 10 to 9 in the morning, but basically he accused them of spouting BS.
That's one person's view, isn't it?
He's a member of the committee. Might he take a different view to you as far as the Angela Kearns situation is concerned?
Let me just deal with that. That was about a completely different issue altogether and should not be confused with the very serious issue that we now have before us. The fact of the matter is that we're being accused of certain things based on what we have done. Based on what we have done. And I would find it remarkable if the members were to agree with what is being said in the affidavit. Certainly I don't. So the legal advisor will provide the advice and the direction which we will follow. And this is, as I've said, a very serious issue, which I take very serious in the context of our democracy and the Oireachtas itself and the works of the PSC. And therefore we will study the papers in detail when and if they are served. And thereafter then we will put in place our position.
Right.
But what you're looking at now is the position of one single person providing it to the court, with the other party, the PSC, still there with the time on its side to respond.
Right, and I think people understand that. One other issue, though, that has arisen is this question of a meeting you had with Angela Kearns prior to her appearance before the committee. And just looking at this morning's Irish Times, it says, echoing views expressed privately by other committee members, the Fine Gael TD Owen Murphy said the committee should have been told about the chairman's contact with Ms Kearns before the February hearing. We should have been informed. If we weren't, I think the chairman has some questions to answer as to his conduct in the manner of investigation pertaining to rehab, Mr Murphy said. How do you respond?
Yeah, firstly, they're commenting on something that is one-sided. There is one side of this story put into the public domain at present because of the actions of Ms Kearns.
Well, do you want to put your side into the public domain?
I will in due course in the courts. But in relation to the question that you've asked me, it's not uncommon for officials or for the chairman to meet with witnesses prior to a public hearing, to explain the context, to explain the procedure, and so on. And that's all that was done. It's as simple as that. And may I say that I think that it was a facility, it's a facility available to anyone that would appear before the committee.
All right.
It's not uncommon and it's not out of the ordinary.
Just as you're with us, I'm sure you're well aware that in your home city in Kilkenny, there's a big row at the moment about a proposed new bridge and road. I gather that there's going to be a special meeting of the council this afternoon. Where do you stand on this?
Well, we just had a local election, and during the course of that local election, serious concern was expressed about the central access scheme. And after that election, having listened to the people, I asked that there should be a review of the plans and a review of the processes. We were told at that time by the county manager that that was not possible because the contractors were signed. I understand now that there have been some changes made in relation to the plan on the county council side, and there is now even more concern about what is happening. And I believe that a review should take place because we need to know how communities around this central access scheme are going to be affected. And we know already that some of them around the city, in Stephen Street and Old Cannon Road and so on, have been affected very negatively and badly by the volumes of traffic travelling through the streets. So we need to know just exactly what this bridge is connecting what to what and what is the purpose of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand there's a special meeting of the council today to inform the members as to what the next steps will be.
All right. Thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning. John McGuinness there, Chair of the Doyle Public Accounts Committee. And as he was saying, there is a special and emergency meeting this afternoon of Kilkenny Council to discuss what's been happening there.
The soon-to-depart Liam McCarthy Cup is slowly being replaced as the most popular attraction in County Clare this summer. Sorry, Rachel. White-tailed sea eagles.
No need for that.
On the shore of Lough Derg, more than 2,500 people have gone along to have a look. Dr. Alan Mee of the Golden Eagle Trust and Project Manager of the White-tailed Sea Eagle Project is on the phone. Alan, good morning.
Morning, Gavin.
Tell us about the eagle and how it ended up in County Clare.
Yeah, the pair of eagles that are in near Mount Shannon breeding the last 3 years, they were originally brought as chicks from Norway and released in Killarney National Park back in 2008 and 2009, the male and female, and they found their way to Lough Derg and they've made their home the last 3 years. So yeah, we're very happy that they're and they're producing chicks now the last 2 years.
And what are the chances of the chicks surviving? How many more do you think we'll have?
Yeah, the chicks' survivorship, you know, it depends really to some extent how they get past the first winter is a really difficult time for young chicks. quite a few die in the first year, but once they make it past the first year, really the only thing that will is a problem for whitetail eagles is, unfortunately, humans, and they can live a long life and breed for many years, given the chance.
Now, if you go along, it's at Mount Shannon Pier, and the viewing site is funded by Clare County Council. How likely are you to see them? I mean, are you guaranteed to see them if you go along?
Yeah, you have a very good chance. I wouldn't say 100% guaranteed when you're dealing with animals, but you know, there's a very good chance. The chick is actually still in the nest, so at the moment you're absolutely guaranteed to see white-tailed eagle. Chick's in the nest, although it's just about to fly any day now, so it's actually moving up the tree out of the nest. But both adults, the parents are around as well, so they're often perched nearby, and you'll have a fantastic view, you know, just in front of the pier in Mount Shannon. You know, it's a wonderful attraction.
Alan, thanks very much. For those who want to have a quick preview of the birds before they go along to County Clare to have a look, we'll post pictures on our website. That's Alan Mee of the Golden Eagle Trust.